Hello, everyone. This is Stuart Weedow, your host of Energy Unplugged, investigating energy in the United States and around the world, and talking about the ideas that can help us move into the future to clean air and also do things in an efficient and also a manner that uses our Earth's resources properly, being good stewards of the Earth's resources. I've got my co-host, Mark Denton, with me today. Mark, how are you?
Good morning. Doing great.
Good. Glad to hear it. I guess you're holding down South Alabama these days.
Yes, sir. I am.
Okay. We're all recovered from the hurricanes that kept coming through this past summer.
It was a busy season, but yes, I think it's finally over.
Well, today we're really excited to have Raymond Van Ash of Renai America Corporation with us today. He is a great innovator in the energy business. And as normally our tradition here, or we're starting to, our tradition is, Raymond, rather than me go into all the details of your background, maybe if you would take a few minutes and introduce yourself versus me doing a poor job with that.
Thank you, Stuart. And good morning, Mark. Once again, my name is Ray Van Ash. I'm currently fulfilling role and responsibility with Renai America Corporation. But I really took kind of a grassroots approach to my career. Family industry back in the day was HVAC, and I started working when I was about 12 years old with my father and grandfather. Realized very early that's not something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I took a keen interest in the engineering industry, and what I had done was realize that to be good, get good at engineering, I really needed to understand the manufacturing side of it as well. So I took a grassroots approach, starting with just running blueprints and delivering drawings very early on for a company that developed solutions for the manufacturing industry, worked into the automotive industry, being located just north of Detroit in Michigan. Again, working from a very low-level detail position, working with General Motors at the time, advanced through the design, engineering, supervision, and leadership, director of engineering for Tesla Motors, and currently fulfilling a role as VP of Innovation for Renai. So there's about 30 years of experience in the auto industry. Also managed an R&D team for General Electric in the Appliance and Lighting Group in Louisville, Kentucky. I was recruited to be a technical lead for Coca-Cola Company here in Atlanta, Georgia, as a technical lead. And then again, most recently, working with the Renai Corporation.
That's great. And Ray, maybe a little bit about Renai. They are, of course, the market leader in tankless water heating systems in the United States. And I remember going back into the day where in Europe and Asia and other places, tankless water heaters were the norm. But here in the United States, we were still using tanked water heaters. And you go back to Paul Harvey, when he was on, that's I think got a lot of exposure, and you almost single-handedly created the tankless water heater market here in the United States. So tell us what Renai is doing these days.
Yeah, Renai really is a manufacturer of gas appliances, including water heaters. What most people don't know here in North America, that we're actually a leader in a wide range of kitchen appliances, as well as space conditioning solutions as well. As a technology leader in the industry, we have over 100 years of history, which is rare nowadays. We actually celebrated our 100-year anniversary back in September.
Wow.
And we're the largest gas combustion appliance manufacturer in Japan. And we're currently the number one selling brand of gas tankless water heaters here in North America.
Well, that's great. And you mentioned space heating products. You've been very prominent for 30 years here in the United States in that area as well, right?
That's correct. Yes. Right. Yeah, we have some unique solutions, high efficiency, high performance, and certainly high quality.
Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about here before we really get into anything else is your experience at Tesla. You were one of the original employees or people that founded with Elon Musk Tesla, and that had to be a very exciting experience to go through.
Yeah, Tesla was kind of in a stealth mode before they hired me. They had developed the Roadster, which most people that have followed Tesla remember, but most people know Tesla today for the development of the Model S. And that particular project was the project that I was hired as the second employee to develop that vehicle. But it was a very unique opportunity for me because it allowed me to apply approximately 30 years of innovation and engineering experience and apply it to an entirely novel solution in a 100-year-old industry. And you know, that's a very rare opportunity in most careers. And I was very blessed to be able to fulfill that role. Again, a rare opportunity. You know,
it was somebody with a very strong will and maybe courage is a word that's too often used to be a disruptor in an industry that's 100 years old, like the automotive industry. So what was that like? And what was Elon Musk like in terms of those early days when you all were trying to disrupt the automotive industry with the electric vehicle?
Yeah, it is very interesting. My wife thought I was crazy, for one, so it took a lot of convincing there. But the whole kind of the premise or foundation for it was to take the rigor and discipline of the auto industry and combine it with the entrepreneurship of the West Coast and the innovation there, and you know, seamlessly blend these two different philosophies and ideation type of backgrounds together to, you know, disrupt an industry. Unfortunately, it didn't work quite as well when we were butting heads every day. Elon, a very intelligent guy, you know, we used to say the West Coast idea of R&D was to release and development like you do electronics. But with the auto industry, you really can't do that because the products we're developing can kill people. So right. we had a lot of back and forth discussions, but I really came to respect his vision. And it, when you think about your career and your role, it really forced me to essentially justify my existence every day with what I knew and what we were bringing to the industry, because you were challenged every day to, you know, do the right thing, make sure we're doing it different, looking at it with a kind of a fresh approach. And although you were leveraging all that background, you had it applied in a very unique way.
Well, that's right. And it's very difficult challenging the status quo. At Alliance Autogas, which is our business focused on converting commercial vehicles to run on propane, which is a fuel that provides 30 to 35% fuel cost savings, but reduces greenhouse gas emissions by 35%. I'm often asked, you know, what are your obstacles? And my first one is always dealing with the status quo. So that was certainly part of the experience at Tesla, I assume.
Exactly that. Yeah, it was, you know, we were challenged almost every different approach that we took because we were a startup challenging the norm. We had difficulty, you know, establishing relationship with suppliers, which were key to our success. And we really, you know, it wasn't this year's version of last year's anything. We didn't have a file cabinet that we could go to pull out drawings of what we did before. It was really a clean sheet of paper. And it was all aluminum body, you know, an electrical engine. We were developing the motor itself and blowing up the test equipment because it couldn't handle the RPM and the torque. So we had to develop that. The manufacturing processes weren't advanced enough to handle some of the component designs and engineering that we need. So we had to even establish novel manufacturing solutions to meet those particular needs as well. So we were engineering a vehicle, we were developing brand new manufacturing processes simultaneously with setting up a manufacturing facility.
Well, that's, I remember reading something 8 or 10 years ago that really was challenging the concept that Tesla or any of these upstart electric vehicle companies could even get something to the marketplace, because it takes decades of experience in manufacturing and the development of manufacturing processes to actually get a car to the market that, as you mentioned earlier, is going to be safe on the road. So that had to be an incredible challenge, just those processes and the development of them.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, when I started, we didn't even have an office. We were literally meeting in Starbucks trying to develop the strategy of how we were going to approach this. And one of my responsibilities was actually recruiting the entire engineering team at the time. And luckily, I have a very strong network in the auto industry and was able to recruit what I consider the top 3 to 5% of the engineering talent. And that's what really helped us kick this off. We were developing, you know, totally unique configurations like within a month versus, you know, a year that it would traditionally take us.
Right. Well, that was a significant contribution to Elon Musk's and Tesla's efforts. I'm sure your experience and knowledge and relationships you had built. And I'll confess right now that Elon Musk is sort of a, he doesn't even know who I am, but everyone knows who Elon is, but he's a bit of a nemesis with this whole electric vehicle marketplace. And one of the reasons I say that is because there's a movement in the country right now about the electrification of everything.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm fascinated by it, but I think it's misguided in the sense that electricity is only a delivery method of energy. It is not a primary source of energy.
That's correct.
So it's great to see innovations and vehicles and other products for the homes across our country. But you're today working for a company that is on internal, you know, combustion engines rather.
Yes.
Using gas. So what is your perspective on this whole movement of electrification of everything and the idea that it's going to save the planet, so to speak?
Yeah, it's again, I think it's a strategy to challenge the norm again. And I think people are taking this particular, call it mantra, a little too far. And it's really based on a lot of what I call bad data. When you look at how the electricity itself is generated, we're about, let's see, I think about 38% of it now is generated through natural gas, but through the transmission losses through the system to your outlet, it's only about 32-35% efficient at that point. And I've been keeping up on it for quite some time now. And when you look at the overall investment in the existing grid infrastructure to be able to provide the electricity needed to satisfy a lot of these legislations that are being considered and have actually passed, it's about a $30 to $40 trillion investment. And you look at the current rolling blackouts and brownouts that are happening in California, it's where do you think that, you know, funding for that type of infrastructure investment is going to come from? It's going to come from your utility rates, and it's going to come from taxes. So I see kind of a conspiracy theory where this electrification movement is going to increase until you get to that particular peak where consumers are starting to push back saying, you know, this is ridiculous. There's no way we can achieve this. Then it's going to fall back down to some level in between. But I think, you know, I'm behind the movement of looking at different energy and fuel sources, because again, I think that need drives the innovation, But the electrification of anything, everything is definitely a stretch and is misguided in its premise.
Well, you know, at Energy Unplugged, we're also members, and we consider ourselves members of the movement to make a positive impact, whether it's on greenhouse gas emissions or emissions that harm human health in some form or another. But there's this concept of how fast can you go? And right now, it seems like the movement itself, the electrification of everything, is letting the very, very good get in the way of the perfect. And the perfect solution could be decades away.
So, yeah. Also, what it's doing is it's eliminating, let's say, the funding and the entrepreneurship to develop new, better, innovative solutions in the propane and natural gas industries as a whole, because you're essentially creating this monopolistic type of scenario where you're no longer considering alternatives.
Right. And that's one of the things we often talk. There are multiple paths to make a positive impact. And we don't want to put all of the proverbial eggs in one basket, meaning the electrification of things, particularly, as you said, with the bad data driving the decision making process. So we need to look at these multiple paths. And that's one of the reasons I'm so excited to have you here today, Ray. And that is to talk about some of the work that you're doing with the micro CHP or the micro, and maybe explain what micro CHP is before we even get down that road, because a lot of people don't know what that term exactly is.
Yeah, CHP, it's an acronym for combined heat and power. What it does is it takes the solutions on the market today take a traditional internal combustion engine driven by different fuel sources to generate heat and power. So heat, whether it be heat generator for water heating or space heating, and power for your electricity, and even battery storage.
Wow, so there's a battery storage component too. So I would assume that that provides an opportunity to couple it with renewable at a home or business. In other words, solar, rooftop solar types of opportunities.
Most of the solutions today, again, the CHP, or also called cogen, it's what I would call a mature, kind of saturated market. There's quite a few manufacturers out there. Some are leading the balance of the manufacturers, but again, it's a mature industry that's currently taking place, and with several solutions, whether it be for residential or commercial. It's considered more of a backup type solution than it is a primary source for your utilities.
Right. They're peak demand management methods, right?
That's correct. Yeah, usually driven by the heat demand.
Well, a lot of people think that the summer is where the greatest demand. It's actually the heating demand in the winter. Isn't that correct, Ray?
Yes. In most markets, it's the heating demand. And
Of course, if you get further south in Florida, what have you, that might be inverted. But if you look at the overall demand throughout the country, that heating demand is significant. And I can't imagine being in an all-electric home in Maine when it's 8 degrees outside. I don't want to be in that house.
Yeah, it's one of those solutions where, again, it's not a one-size-fits-all because the utility demand, depending on your particular market or geographic area, is very different. And a lot of it is driven by utility rates as well, where, let's say, in the Northwest, where you take advantage of the electricity through hydro
right.
versus the Northeast, which is primarily natural gas and propane.
That's right. And unfortunately, in places like Vermont, environmental movement has been successful in shutting down their nuclear plant, which is one of the most only emissions-free source of centralized power generation in this country. And they're substituting it with, of all things, in the city of the capital of Vermont, in Burlington, they have wood-fired power generation, which is about the worst thing you could do. It's worse than coal.
That's right. Yeah. And it's, again, it's this what I call kind of extreme thinking that you know, you're really not looking at it holistically, what the solution should be. And maybe today that our solutions aren't the best, but it certainly should drive that innovation to keep looking at it and improve the product over time. It should really be the catalyst for the innovations that we need to develop.
What is Renai doing to be able to communicate out to John Public about CHP and other technologies to move away from, you know, more dependence on the grid?
Yeah, I've been invited to speak at a lot of these energy and utility consortiums, and it's been a great opportunity for me. It's just communicating from, let's say, a manufacturer's perspective as to, you know, what the demand is on us to develop these high performing solutions. And it's really interesting because I would say 75-80% of these consortiums that I've either spoke at or been asked to participate in, it's basically the exact same dialogue. And it's really interesting to me because after I speak, they all come up to me and said, thank you for coming, Kendra, because we never really had the perspective of a manufacturer in the decisions we're making. So what we're trying to do is bring these organizations together, because through that experience, everybody is essentially duplicating what everybody else is doing with their resources, whether it's time resource, people resource, or certainly financial resource. So what we're trying to do is bring these people together with the common vision and goal to work together and to leverage each other's expertise and resources to ensure that we're developing the solutions that they need to fill this unmet market need and that our customers are willing to pay for.
And I would think the more advanced customers that were already making the move toward a tankless water heater, for example, they're looking for ways to save on energy and be more efficient.
Yeah, that's an interesting point too, because when you look at traditional gas storage, let's say, it's very similar to the auto industry. You know, it's this historical solution that's always been there, and penetrating, you know, that particular market with new and advanced technologies is real difficult. Launching innovation in general is very difficult. But when you look at from an energy perspective, your traditional gas storage is about, you know, arguably 20 to 25% of your total energy cost. When you get that word out there, people start shaking their head going, well, what's alternative? And then you look at gas tankless, which, you know, those solutions are north of 95% efficient, but yet it only has about a 15 to 16 adoption or conversion rate. So we're really on the, you know, the leading slope of that early adopter when it comes to the technology itself, even though it's been out there for, you know, 25, 26 plus years.
Well, speaking of disruption, Ray, I mean, you mentioned earlier on a centralized grid system, you know, 32% on average across the country of the energy that goes into a power plant gets to the plug at a home or business. That's a really astonishing number when you stop and think of it, and one I don't think many people understand. But we have this system of utilities across the country. They're very powerful. As I like to say, they fly into every state capital on a weekly basis with three or four Learjets, and they're very powerful politically. But they have this business model that they've invested tens of billions of dollars in, really hundreds of billions on an individual basis. And on-site power generation or something such as a micro CHP is very disruptive to their business model. So this is maybe similar to your experience with Tesla in terms of being disruptive. Before we get into that, though, can you give a little insight, since we know what the central grid is, what the efficiency opportunities are with the use of energy for on-site power in a micro CHP type of unit?
It's very high, actually. Again, with some of the technologies and advancements with a CHP, you can essentially be grid independent. to where you no longer need that particular utility from traditional sources. What I'd like to see is essentially the day where any residential location or any commercial location by choice can be independent of the grid and actually feed back to the grid, especially with those high demand. A lot of people don't understand that your electric utility rates actually fluctuate throughout the day relative to that particular peak demand. And what I'd like to see is these on-site utility solutions be able to feed back to the grid to essentially level set that overall utility rate that the consumers are currently experiencing.
That's interesting. There could be some cost savings for individual consumers if they have this type of equipment at their home, and there's an ability to, the technical term, I guess, is net meter, send the use back to the grid in peak periods, right?
Yeah, exactly. And another, key application, I would say, I used to be a licensed builder in Michigan as well, and built a pretty good network of different builders and come to know some builders in the Atlanta, Georgia area as well. And one of their, key issues right now is getting the utility companies on site at their projects to start the development of these subdivisions. And you can envision the day where we have these utility solutions in a single solution on the bed of a trailer connected to a propane tank that now you can pull it on site and immediately fire it up and you're ready to go with your development. You have the utility, all the utility needs that you have.
Mobile power generation, so to speak, not with a diesel generator, which if we got rid of coal and diesel in this country, I think we would make tremendous progress in terms of the air quality we have. And using gas is certainly a better transition in that regard. So I don't want to pin you down to a number right now, but if the grid's at 32% on average, when you have the micro CHP, you could have in excess of 65 or 70% efficiency in terms of the use of the energy itself. Is that in the ballpark now, or is it still
Absolutely. Again, we're looking at, again, the traditional approach and looking at it from a fresh set of eyes to identify all the sources of inefficiency in the particular systems, and virtually eliminating them by taking a different approach to these off-the-shelf, call it major systems in the overall solution to identify novel approaches there as well. So again, it's a moving target, and it's like month over month we're identifying new ways to increase overall efficiency with our current products as well as the future projects we have in the queue.
Without getting too far into details, you mentioned that you have a battery with the system that you are working on. And again, Renai is being extremely innovative, and you're leading that effort along with the engineers at Renai today. But with the battery, I assume, as I mentioned, or you could couple that with solar. So when the sun is shining, which it doesn't always do, those who are expecting solar and wind to fuel the grid system of the future, I think maybe don't even know that it's right at 3 to 3.3% of the current grid. And we'd have to spend, as you mentioned, $40 trillion, which when you get down to it, that's always the initial estimate. It's probably triple that. But you could use solar at your home, and that would charge the battery.
Right.
Since solar is incurably intermittent, sun doesn't always shine, you still have that battery for a period of time, but it's integrated with the micro CHP. Is that how you all are conceptualizing the product for a home or a business right now?
Yeah. Again, we're not vetted to any particular technology. It's just evaluating everything that is available to us today. And what we also do is go through an exercise of what we call futuring, to where we're kind of limited to what's available today. But when we look at and expose ourselves to all these different technologies that are currently being developed, we actually take that and integrate it into the solutions as well, to where we're able to take a modular approach where we can plug in new technologies, new solutions, even new products, let's call it, as the advancements in these technologies take place.
Interesting. What was that term again? Future or something?
Futuring. It's something we used to do in the auto industry as well that I brought to Renai in the water heating. It's taking a look at current technologies and not just focusing on, let's say, water heating alone, but looking at what's happening in other industries and other markets and the advancements in performance and efficiencies there to see what may apply to your particular markets.
I see. Interesting. And you mentioned the investment. Just as by way of example, we had a visit with Jeff Stewart out in California, who's in the LP gas business there. We were discussing the rates that people pay. Where you live in Georgia, it's probably around 10 to 11 cents per kilowatt, but it's, you know, between 27 and 32 or 33% out in California. And, you know, that's astonishing in terms of its impact, particularly on middle and lower income folks who are out working every day, trying to provide for their families and live a comfortable life. But somebody's going to have to pay for these massive investments that are being envisioned for the electrification of everything. How does this micro CHP technology stack up in that environment? We talk about economic justice sometimes. If you're a well-to-do person, at least financially and blessed in that regard, it may be a very small percentage of your income you're spending on electricity. But if you're a lower income person, it could be as much as a third of your energy. Energy is as much a third of your income that goes to pay those bills. And that's a large burden. And we do not want to create that type of burden for folks that are out there just working hard every day to make a good living. How does the micro CHP stack up in terms of its potential to still have these positive impacts on the environment and efficiency, but in terms of the cost associated with where this may be going and our electric rates around the country?
Again, when you look at current or traditional CHP technologies, they're taking an ICE or internal combustion engine that's really designed and developed to run most efficient at a set RPM. What we're looking at doing is actually being able to modulate that solution based on particular demand. So instead of running a, let's say, you know, a very high RPM that is set to accommodate the maximum demand for your utilities, we're able to look at different solutions and different technologies to be able to modulate that to have the actual output meet the demand with very little waste and therefore run at the highest performance and highest efficiency. And again, these particular solutions can be independent of the grid or they can be tied to the grid. Again, the net metering that you mentioned earlier is of keen interest to the utility companies because now they can actually essentially activate the system to be able to provide power back to the grid to level set these high utility rates, high demand rates that fluctuate throughout the day. And again, a lot of those utility rates that you quoted are on average. It doesn't even establish or compensate for the peak demand rates that consumers are realizing. And although, you know, the higher income customers may not feel it as much as the lower income customers, I also think that they're very prudent in investing in these new technologies and this early adopter approach, which helps drive the adoption of new innovation in general.
Yeah, that's just brilliant. It's similar to, or not unlike the tankless water heater. With a tanked water heater, you're heating water all the time, even if you're on vacation.
That's correct.
With an on-demand Rinnai tankless water heater, you're only heating water when you're using it. So
yeah. Traditional storage, again, it runs whether it needs to maintain that set temperature.
Right. And so you all are taking the same concept or approach with your micro CHP units in terms of it's working hard or not at all, depending on what the demand is in the home, right?
Right. It only really works when it has to. And when you integrate the battery storage, let's say, solution to it and the renewable solution to it, it's amazing how little it actually needs to run throughout the day to maintain or to meet the particular demands of the utilities for a particular consumer.
Well, I don't want to expose anything that you all feel is proprietary, but you also have something called a micro CCHP. Do you care to comment on the extra C in that phrase, in that term?
I would love to, but unfortunately I can't.
Okay. that's fine. I won't press you on that one then.
I know. Is most of the micro CHP now, is it primarily residential, or are you seeing some light and to heavier commercial applications?
No, there's definitely a commercial applications out there. Again, the solutions that are available are based on demand. But when you look at your heat and power requirements, that CHP solution is designed, engineered, and manufactured to meet that particular demand. So they have different levels of output based on whether it's a residential demand or a commercial demand. And again, it's mostly used as a backup versus a primary source of that utility.
Okay. Well, Mark, this has to be interesting to you. Ray, you started off in the heating and air business and decided you wanted to do something different and become a big wheel or whatever. So, I mean, if going back 30 plus years in your career, what would your perception have been as a heating and air person in terms of this type of product that might be available to the marketplace at some point?
Yeah, I look at, you know, traditional gas forced air systems, it's the solution that's been out there forever. Very little challenge against it, much less efficient than what we have today. Rinnai, in the middle of last year, actually launched a hydronic heating system where we pair our tankless system to a radiant system, and it's a very efficient, it's a great solution, very well received, and it's one of the things that, you know, we're slowly getting to the point of commercialization of some of these projects we've been developing since I started there.
In fact, I'm building a home. Some of our folks at Blossom and Gas have that hydronic system, and they are just absolutely thrilled with it. You still have the compressor to run the air conditioner, but you have your tankless water heater circulating. Explain how that works exactly with your tankless water hooked up to an air handler, so you have also heat in your home.
Yeah, what it is, it's essentially a closed-loop system where you have your set point for your space conditioning temperature. And what we do is we use our tankless water heating technology and gas combustion controls to regulate the temperature of the water flow through the closed loop system. And it's a very efficient, very pleasing type of temperature control, which traditional gas forced air systems tend to dry out the air, where you need a supplemental humidification system to compensate for that. But when you're working with a hydronic system and actually heating water through thermodynamics to actually get the space conditioning warmth that you're looking for, you no longer need that humidification system. So again, it's improving the overall system effect of that space conditioning solution. So it's, again, looking at it holistically to essentially take out the non-value-added components or solutions that meet that demand.
That's a really great value, whether it's a desiccant dehumidification or other some sort of dehumidification system. You virtually eliminate for that cost or the need to have that in your system with this hydronic approach, it sounds
that's
like.
Right. And all the health concerns that go along with it.
Right. Yes.
So, Ray, are you seeing more HVAC professionals who are trying to get a higher AFUE and SEER ratings looking at this new technology with micro CHP in order to get there?
Not necessarily micro CHP with the SEER rating, no. But what they are looking at is different solutions with air handlers themselves and pairing them to other appliances, let's say, such as our tankless water heating, to get an overall, call it, what I call a cubic solution. So everything within that particular product, they're looking at it more holistically to pair solutions together to get the overall best performance and efficiency.
Let's talk a little bit about Rinnai since you've been there, Ray. I know that the CEO, Rinnai, has brought a new spirit here, at least to Rinnai of America. Rinnai, the 100-year-old company in Japan, is well known for extremely high-quality products. But what do you see happening to Rinnai of America in terms of maybe not the word culture, I don't like that word, but the spirit of innovation? How is Rinnai evolving in this period of time?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, bringing the spirit of innovation into a Japanese type of culture. When you look at the culture itself, it's all about evolution, continuous improvements, kaizen, constantly improving your existing products. And when you look at an innovative approach, I say it's more of a revolutionary type of approach. So when you look at the experiences that I've had coupled with that evolutionary approach, it's really, you know, optimizing an overall organizational vision to, you know, make sure that we're focusing on the core quality that the Rinnai brand has been known for, but actually, you know, leveraging that expertise and experience to be able to look at some of these innovative solutions that really meets these unmet market needs right now. So it's really a perfect combination to be able to take that, you know, that type of culture, a very successful culture, and applying it in an innovative environment.
Yeah, and companies that are 100 years old aren't generally known for being innovative, to a point you made earlier today, but it's a shift in many regards, because when you're out innovating and pursuing revolutionary type of products, you're going to fail.
Absolutely.
At times, you know, the famous Thomas Edison quote, "I didn't fail 10,000 times, I learned something."
That's right. That's right. Yeah,
is definitely. And just evolving on a continuous basis.
Yeah, and what I like about it too is, again, you know, that rigor and discipline within that culture helps guide you in the innovations that you're looking at. So a lot of entrepreneurial type of people, you know, they've got their focus on the eyes on the prize type of scenario. But what we have done internally is I actually put together a new product development processes, which is essentially based on a stage gate process. And what it does is it really organizes all the tasks and deliverables from each discipline that we should be doing anyway, but it organizes it in a very prescriptive approach to ensure that we're developing this particular new product the way it should be to ensure that we're commercializing a high quality product that meets all the specifications on time.
Right. You know, I remember reading a story about a Silicon Valley tech firm forming a joint venture with one of the large pharmaceutical companies, and they were trying to develop an innovative new product, and ultimately it failed. And the folks from the tech company went back and say, hey, you know, we gave it our best shot. We learned a lot. We'll figure it out next time. And the pharmaceutical representatives were petrified to go back and tell upper management that the project failed. It shows you the difference in cultures. And
yes,
we have to applaud. We need everything in terms of creative entrepreneurs and innovators and enterprising people. And when you mix that with know-how, like you all have at Renai, that sounds like a winning combination to me.
Yeah, again, it's very similar to what we did at Tesla. When you have a lot of experience in something, you tend to overlook the need to be able to explain your particular position to those that may not have that experience. And that's why I really like it, because it keeps me in line with some of the things that I'm thinking about to ensure that I'm focused on that quality that we're known for, but yet being responsible for, you know, expanding our current product portfolio into these other markets is a key to our continued growth.
Right. Well, we're all leaves and branches on a tree, and we bring different talents to the game.
That's right.
Okay. Well, Ray, we're so pleased to have had you here to visit with us today. And thank you for sharing all of your experiences with Tesla and in your career, but also some of the exciting things that that Renai is working on in terms of products that can improve the environment and help people have the comfort that they need in their homes. Mark, do you have anything else that you had on your mind today?
No, I appreciate it. I've learned a lot, Ray. Thank you for being so transparent. I think this is an evolving energy, is something that we're all interested in. And we're trying to, with this podcast, get that out to the public so that we can learn from each other.
No, I really appreciate the invitation. It's something I'm very passionate about, and currently in a role that I'm blessed to be able to, you know, take that passion and actually apply it to, you know, the organization and the industry that we're currently working in. And, you know, I appreciate it. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, thank you again. So Ray Van Ash of Renai America Corporation has been our guest today. Very informative. And I'm signing off, Stuart Weedye and Mark Denton for Energy Unplugged, and hope you have a great day. Until next time.